The United States of America, the greatest, richest nation in human history. So where do our schools stand by comparison with those of other nations? Not where they should. Our schools, where they stand, and what can be done. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. A graduate of the United States Air Force Academy and the holder of a doctorate from MIT, Eric Hanushek is a fellow at the Hoover Institution here at Stanford. A professor of government at Harvard and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, Paul Peterson received his doctorate from the University of Chicago. Both Rick Hanushek and Paul Peterson have written dozens of articles and books on American education. Most recently, they joined Ludger Wossmann in co-authoring a book, Endangering Prosperity, A Global View of the American School. Rick and Paul, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Harvard, Stanford, these and other American universities rank among the finest in the world. And despite the recession and the slow growth of recent years, the United States remains, even now, one of the richest countries in history. So what is it, if we've got great universities and a rich country, what is it about our schools that endangers our prosperity? Paul?
Well, you know, we once did have the finest educational system in the world at the elementary and secondary level as well. We, in the 19th century, were the first to have universal elementary education. We were the first in the 20th century to build a system of secondary schools, high schools, that was nationwide, and a very large percentage of the students attended those schools. The Europeans were fighting over religious issues and never got down to the basics. We left it all up to our local communities to build these schools, and they did it very rapidly. But somewhere around 1960, this steady improvement in our educational system began to stabilize and stagnate, and the rest of the world has caught up with us and passed us by.
And what's the link, Rick, between our educational system and prosperity?
In simplest terms, economic growth or the future well-being of a society depends upon the skills of its population. And it's hard to get away from that. If you look across the world, you see that countries that have a more skilled population and more skilled workforce grow faster. Now, the U.S. has had also the best economic institutions and has allowed us to escape our fate for a while because we have free and open labor and capital markets, good property rights, less intrusion of government, all the things that economists think are really important for economic growth. And that's allowed us to do better than you would expect given the quality of our education.
But sooner or later, if you're producing badly educated kids, you'll have badly educated workers, managers. It'll work its way through the economic system.
That's precisely the point.
All right. Math. Question here is, how bad is it? So let's go through, let's lay the case as you do in your book, Endangering Prosperity. Quote, Endangering Prosperity, U.S. students in the class of 2011 with a 32% proficiency rate in math came in 32nd, no less than 58 by comparison with American 32, no less than 58% of Korean students, and 56% of Finnish students performed at the proficient level. Many other nations had math proficiency rates well above that of the United States, including Germany, Australia, and France. Shanghai topped the list with a 75% math proficiency rate. 32nd among nations in math proficiency. So first of all, let's just do away with the skepticism that might be latent here. How do you know? How can you have confidence in cross-cultural, cross-national comparisons of this kind?
Well, first of all, you've got a test that's being administered by the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's been around since the year 2000, been administered several times. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty well-developed test.
And it's math. 2 + 2 = 2, wherever in the world you are.
Yeah, we also have it in reading and science, but the math is the best test because math is math, right? It doesn't change. It's totally objective. Right. And secondly, we know that math is extremely important for economic growth. Of all the skills that you learn in high school, the one that's most correlated with growth of the economy over time is the math skills. Those are the skills that are in scarce supply in a society. So substantively, math is really important. But to come to your point about how do you know, well, a lot of people have put a lot of time into measurement, and these tests are pretty well-honed tests.
All right. Let me continue to come to you, Rick, but with a new quotation here from Endangering Prosperity. And of course, the other question that immediately may pop to mind is, well, but yes, but we have so many more recent immigrants. Okay, and you address that. It may be worth inquiring as to whether the difference between the United States and other countries is attributable to the substantial minority population in the United States. While the 42% rate of math proficiency for U.S. white students is much higher than the averages for students from African American and Hispanic backgrounds, U.S. white students are still surpassed by all students in 16 other countries. So let me make sure I understand that. If the entire country looked like, I think the last time I checked, the least diverse state was Oregon, the whitest state was, if the whole country were white, we'd still rank only 16. Is that correct?
That's correct. But more than that, we've actually gone on to look at how does somebody with a college-educated parent do in the U.S. versus other countries of the world. And what we find is not very well, that this our college-educated parents that have children in U.S. public schools don't do any better in worldwide comparisons than college-educated parents and their children in Germany or Britain or all of the 32 countries.
So you're working very hard to separate the job the school is doing or should be doing from the individual student's socioeconomic background. And if you're a rich white kid, both of whose parents went to college, and you go to an American public school, you're still getting, on the statistics, you're still likely to get a bad education.
Well, we like to think of it this way. There are two big gaps. One is the gap between the rich and the poor that we hear so much about, mm-hmm. or the well-educated and the not so well-educated, which is pretty much the same thing. And that's a gap that we all know about. Right. But the gap among the well-educated in the United States, the kids from families that are well-educated, and the kids from well-educated families in other parts of the world, our peers, the leading industrialized countries in the world, it's just as big. It's just as big. So these there are two gaps out there. And we are in the United States are only focusing on one gap. And this right. book is trying to say, look, there are two gaps. We got to address both of these problems.
Reading is a little mysterious. You see, only 31%, I'm quoting again, Endangering Prosperity, only 31% of U.S. students in the class of 2011 were identified as proficient in reading. In Korea, 47%, Finland, 46%, Singapore and New Zealand, 42%, Japan and Canada, 41%, Australia, 38%, Belgium, 37%. Our performance is still bad, but not quite as bad as in math. How come? Why does any guesses as to what? Or guesses?
Well, I actually
you're experts. You should know. I'm not asking for a guess. What's the answer?
I wouldn't make such a big deal out of those slight differences. The reading is much more difficult to test internationally right. because it's in different languages. With math, you take a math problem, translate it across languages and march it around the world. With reading, it's a little bit harder. But the story is identical in many ways. We're still not competitive. We are not what many Americans think first in the world. We're far from it.
And our reading scores have slipped in the last 3 years. When we wrote this book, we were relying on data from 2009. Mm-hmm. Now we have 2012 data, and the reading test is falling down to the math level. It's not quite there yet, but we're sliding down the world scale.
All right. Why it matters. You calculate in Endangering Prosperity the difference it would make to the United States over the lifetime of a child. So you're using a big stretch of time, basically from today until 2093, 8 decades. If we improved our educational performance. Endangering Prosperity, quote, matching the level of achievement of our northern neighbor, Canada, would be the equivalent of adding 20% to the paycheck of every worker for every year of work. Reaching the achievement level of Singapore would be the equivalent of a 43% salary increase, close quote. All right, again, the skepticism. Projecting anything over 8 decades is very tricky. How did you... How robust do you consider this finding, or is it just a kind of heuristic to say, really, we'd be richer if we knew more?
Well, what's really robust is looking at history, and history over the last half century says that there is a very tight relationship between the skills of the population and growth rates. Now, you're correct that projecting into the future is hazardous. I mean, many of the countries that we see today might not be there in 80 right. years. But if anything like history holds for the future, you get these numbers that are just completely out of sight, that are 7-10 times our current GDP in terms of value. Now, the other answer, your skepticism is correct because the numbers are so large, nobody knows what $1 trillion is.
That's true.
And that's what we're talking about. But if you think that we're wrong and that we're overly optimistic, just cut these numbers in half. You know, and if you cut them in half, you still have numbers that suggest that we can deal with our current fiscal problems that's consumed Washington, or we could deal with our income distribution problems that everybody's talked about and have money left over.
Actually, you just touched on something very important in my judgment about the book. Endangering prosperity, you make the case that unless Americans know more, they will be poorer than they need to be. And this comparison, our current trajectory versus the Canada trajectory versus the Singapore, that all sounds as though you're just trying to make us richer. But in fact, there's a couple of passages in the book where you reveal what I would take to be deeper motives, in which you write about the problem of inequality, the budget problem, various social tensions of all kinds. And what you're saying is that if you have economic growth, all kinds of things in a country go better. That's real. You're not saying purely we could all be richer. You're saying we could live in a better, more peaceful, a friendlier society.
Well, that's what people do with their money. You know, when they have wealth, they can use it to do good things. That's why we want wealth. That's why we want to create wealth. And we now know that human capital is the most important thing for creating wealth. Why aren't we creating as much human capital as we possibly can in this country? It's quite extraordinary because our history says that we always did this in the past. Mm-hmm. Why did the United States emerge as the dominant industrial power by the time of the World War I when we were just a little agricultural nation on the fringes of the world 100 years earlier? And we went through a terrible civil war in the meantime.
Right.
We did it through our educational system. We had national markets that helped a lot as well. But our educational system was the engine that drove the human growth in the 19th and in the 20th century. So why are we giving up on it? Why is it that the American public doesn't say, we've got to come to grips with this problem? We can't just sit on our hands and let vested interests run our school system.
One more, once again, from your book, Endangering Prosperity, listen to this litany that you provide of national summonses to action. 1958, Congress enacts the National Defense Act. 1983, President Reagan's task force entitled A Nation at Risk, which contained, well, I can remember when it was published because it was so shocking. If a foreign power had done to us what our own school system has done, we would consider it an act of war. 1989, President George H.W. Bush joins all 50 governors in setting the goal that the United States would top international rankings by 2000. That was a generation ago. We're at 32 now. Work to be done. 1993, President Clinton reaffirms that goal, which failed. 2001, President George W. Bush, the No Child Left Behind Act. 2012, a task force chaired by former New York City Schools Chancellor Joel Klein and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice concludes, quote, America's failure to educate is affecting its national security, close quote. And after all of this, we rank 32nd. So you ask the question, I return it to you. Why?
Why is this happening? Well, that's a big question. We don't try to answer it in this book. We think that the vested interests have captured control of our school system. The people who are working in the schools are trying to create a system that runs very well for the adults who work there. And they are so concerned about that they don't focus on the needs of the students. So what I think we need to do about it is we need to be looking very closely at the quality of our teachers. How can we attract better teachers into education? That's the terribly important thing. We need to give parents a lot more choice so that they can choose among mm-hmm. schools. That will force schools to pay more attention to the quality of their teachers. And we need to hold students accountable. We need to tell students, this is what you have to learn, and we want to see that you're learning it before we're going to give you that diploma.
Mm-hmm. One other point on what's happened. While all these national summonses were taking place, it's not as if nothing happened, quote, endangering prosperity. This is the most exasperating two sentences I've read in months. Current education expenditures per pupil in dollars adjusted for inflation are some 2.5 times what they were in 1970. In real terms, we are spending 250% more per pupil than we were in 1970. To continue the quotation, an educational moonshot has taken place. If money were the answer, the solution would be in place. Close quote. It is a commonplace of American life at this stage in the 21st century that if you spend more money on something, you get more of it. We are now spending 2.5 times per pupil what we were spending in 1970 and getting less actual education. How is that possible? Where's the money going?
So if I could reinforce that a little bit. In the book, we also spend a lot of time trying to compare individual states
right.
to the
yes.
rest of the
yes.
world and to each other. So we have 50 experiments with the different states. And if you look at the change in what each state has spent since 1990 till today, in 2 decades, and look at what's happened to student performance, you find that there's no correlation between the states that spent the most and the states that...
Okay. Stop there. You are a social scientist at a major university. When you say no correlation, you mean it. Zero correlation.
I mean zero. The state that has spent the least in real term increases over the last 2 decades is Florida, and it's the third fastest growth in achievement over that same time period, whereas other states that have spent a lot of money have gotten no improvement or maybe even a decline in their student achievement.
All right, so I scratch my head and I say, well, where did the money go in that case? And I find myself drawn to this quotation from Endangering Prosperity. The battle is a conflict between the needs of school-age children and the interests of those adults who have agreed to educate them in our public schools. The school workforce too often favors only those changes to the status quo that enhance their income or lighten their workload, close quote. Now, you're professionals. You have to maintain a dispassionate tone. But this layman says, oh, I get it. The teachers' unions, that money has gone to making people, grown-ups, more comfortable, hiring more teachers' aides, higher and higher salaries, especially bigger and bigger pensions. Am I on? You don't say
you're,
that in the
you're
book.
You're on, Paul has
because
some,
be,
some
but
great...
But I realize this is tricky ground for you yeah. because you want to be dispassionate. You want people to see the facts, act on them. But that's what's going on, isn't it?
Paul has some great survey information on this.
Well, it is true also that we have smaller classes than we did. There's a lot of people who say, okay, small classes is the answer.
We did buy smaller classes. We did buy something.
Right. And the public really does like smaller classes. That's very popular. Unfortunately, it doesn't get you very much. I won't say it doesn't get you anything, but it doesn't get you very much, and it is incredibly expensive. Mm. And it's not so much that teachers are earning so much more relative to other occupations today than they did in the past, but a lot more money is going into pensions and medical services, and the payment for that is coming out of the taxpayer rather than the employee.
I have to add just one thing before we go on, and that is teacher salaries have gone up, but unfortunately, the salaries paid to individual teachers is unrelated to how good they are in the classroom, to how effective right. they are. So that if we just raise everybody's salary, we're not raising the salaries of the most effective.
If I were forced to try to construct a defense for the unions, it would take the following form, I think. I'm making this up as I go along, so this will be crude, but you'll see my point. Technology has permitted the American labor force overall to become more productive. So wage rates overall have been rising. Teaching still, to a very large extent, is one teacher in one classroom. So the other day I took a tour of the Tesla car factory, and they're running through car after car after car. I counted fewer than 24 human beings on the floor. It was all computers, software has made people, we can now make 100 cars in a day with a couple dozen workers. But you still need the same number of teachers in such and such an elementary school around the corner today that you needed in 19.
No, we need more.
Peter, we have twice as many. We have twice as many adults per 100 students today as we had in 1960.
So I'm just told that the wage rate argument is just goes nowhere.
It's just more people. A lot of them may be sitting in offices. They may not be teaching at all. But there's more people inside the school district than ever before,
all
per
right.
100 students. Yeah.
All right. So we've bought smaller classes, which cuts us very little. Mm-hmm. And we've added teachers.
And administrators.
And administrators.
And specialists.
And specialists. What is to be done? Endangering prosperity. Quote, in some parts of the United States, and you mentioned improvements in several states, including Maryland, Florida, several others. In some parts of the United States and some parts of the world, rapid student achievement gains are being realized. If it can happen elsewhere, including in parts of the United States, there is no reason it cannot happen throughout the country, close quote. Well, okay, what do you propose? Frontal assaults on teachers' unions. We have had some experiments with that in the political system. There have been initiatives here in California, school choice initiative. They don't work. Teachers' unions are well-funded and well-organized. What do we do?
No, that's not quite right.
Oh, is that not so?
That's not quite right, because in the last 5 years, states have dramatically changed the rules for schools, for teachers' unions, for evaluation of teachers, so that now a large proportion, perhaps half of the states, require annual evaluations of all teachers. Another large number of states require evaluation of the effectiveness in the classroom before a teacher gets tenure. Now, that might sound surprising that I mentioned that. It seems so obvious that that should be done. But until 5 years ago, very few states required a judgment about teacher effectiveness.
Well, we're taking small steps in the right direction in some states. And there's this court case that's just happened in California, mm-hmm. which is very interesting because there's a possibility now that the school system can dismiss its least effective teachers, whereas that's been extremely difficult.
And the court case was?
Vergara versus California.
And the holding was that certain union rules were unconstitutional because the state of California has a constitution that guarantees the right to a decent education. Is that?
So there were five statutes. They're not union rules. They're five statutes of the state. One says that essentially after 16 months in the classroom, you have to give tenure to a teacher or make a decision on tenure to a teacher. That's even before they finish their induction program that you have to make a decision. There are three statutes that relate to what's required to dismiss a teacher and makes it completely onerous to dismiss an ineffective teacher. And then there's one statute that says if you're going to reduce the number of teachers you have to lay off the last in, so last in, first out. And the court, and the argument in the court case was very simple. These statutes have the effect of maintaining some grossly ineffective teachers in the schools, and somebody has to get one of these grossly ineffective teachers, so that it was a violation of equal protection of students. It also, it turns out to be the case that if you look at major urban centers, more disadvantaged schools with more disadvantaged students have more grossly ineffective teachers, so that it's also discriminatory on the basis of the backgrounds of kids.
I see. All right. Let me, a pair of items. Here's a line of, a whole line of consideration. I'd like to know what you make of it. Here's one item. We've known since the 1966 Coleman Report that academic achievement in schools correlates very heavily with family background. Kids with one parent do better than kids with none, kids with two parents better than kids with one, and so forth. That's item one. Item two, 1965, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of Daniel Patrick Moynihan's famous report, quote, the Negro Family, the Case for National Action. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote about the breakdown of the African-American family in the inner city and said this will guarantee poverty and poor education for generation unto generation. And when he published that report, the illegitimacy rate among African-Americans was 25%. Today it's over 70% for African-Americans, over 50% for Hispanics, well over 30% for white American, non-Hispanic white Americans, over 40% for the country as a whole. So you very carefully carve out the family as something you're not going to consider in this book. But don't we have to consider it? If the American family continues to disintegrate, aren't you asking too much of the schools to put those pieces back together? Or is,
Peter,
am I
this,
just, am I thinking?
Peter, this is such a good question because it's just wrong to say the family's not important for the educational system. And we don't want to be interpreted as having said that. It is, you're absolutely right, the Coleman Report was accurate at the time. It's remains accurate for today. Family background is the most important fact. You know, the most important person in a child's life for how much they learn in school is the child. Yeah. How devoted to their task are they? Is that child? And then it's the mom, I think. And then the dad's getting more important. Mm-hmm. And of course, you need two parents in order. It's really hard to have an effective learning experience without the support of two parents. Now, there can be heroic mothers and fathers who can do it on their own, but it's really, really important what you say. But having said that, it's truly amazing that the problem isn't just that problem, that even those people who come from families where the parents are well-educated, that they're not keeping up with the rest of the world. There are two big problems. There's the gap within the United States that you just laid out so well, and there's the gap between the United States and the other leading countries of the world. We've got to address both of these problems.
So I agree with Paul on this, but take a slightly different perspective, and that is we're generally reluctant to intervene very much in the family. But we have chosen the schools to do the job for us to try to help our future generations out. And the schools have the capacity. If you look at what the impact of having good teachers is on kids from bad backgrounds, you see that they can change lives. One study that I did a long time ago suggested in Gary, Indiana, poor old industrial city of the U.S., for all poor, all black parents, the best teachers got 1.5 years of learning each academic year. The worst teachers got half a year of learning each academic year. So depending on what classroom you were assigned to, you were a year different at the end in terms of what you knew. What this suggests is that if we paid more attention to teacher effectiveness and actually acted upon what we know, we could, in fact, make up for lots of these difficulties. It's not that we're condoning or want to accept the family background problems that some kids have. It's that we have this instrument that has been given to us to try to overcome some of the problems.
Got it. A couple of other solutions. I'd just like to know what you make of 2001, No Child Left Behind Act. Did it do any good?
Yes.
It did?
Yes.
All right, let me quote Paul Peterson in the Wall Street Journal. During the Clinton-Bush era, white nine-year-olds gained, you were writing about No Child Left Behind. White nine-year-olds gained 11 points in math, African-American student performance rose by 13 points, and Hispanic student performance leaped by 21 points. Those remarkable gains came to an end after the Obama administration took charge, close quote.
Well, you know, we gave up on No Child Left Behind about 2008. It was actually even before the current president took office. There was so much opposition, mainly coming from the teacher unions, that it was becoming increasingly difficult to enforce the provisions of No Child Left Behind. And now that has been formalized by the current administration.
Various waivers and exceptions and
so forth. Yeah, 45 states, I think, have waivers from complying. That's pretty much
that does it.
Gutting the law. So the law has now been gutted. And the performance of students in our schools has declined since that decision was made.
So can I reinforce that, though? The original No Child Left Behind Act of 2001, which started in 2002, was to be reauthorized in 2007, revisit this monumental undertaking to write a, what accountability should look like. After 2002, large numbers of people, including Paul and myself, recognized that there were flaws in this act. It was better than having no act, but there were flaws in it. We have failed to address any of those flaws, but it is clear that accountability in general, where we measure student performance and hold people responsible for it, has a positive impact on learning, or has had a positive impact on learning.
Okay. This one, you just can't talk about education without talking about the core curriculum. And I came across, I scoured your work, and here's what I came up with. Paul, quote, "I do not join those who oppose Common Core state standards," close quote. Now, if that isn't an endorsement of the Common Core, it is a mighty tepid one, Doctor.
It's kind of weak, isn't it?
The person here on my left, and I emphasize the left, is a critic of the Common Core. My own feeling about the Common Core is that the discussion of it has given the unions the excuse to say, well, now let's stop testing students, let's stop expecting teachers to perform.
I wrote that.
So that's definitely the negative side. I think it is also important that we have to have national standards. We have to set up national expectations for students. And the Common Core, for all of its limitations, has moved in that direction. Now, other countries have that. The French have it, the Koreans have it, the Canadians have this at the provincial level. So it's not that we don't need to think about the problem that the Common Core is trying to address.
So here's something.
It's just that we can't give up other things to get
now
to that.
Now that I've got you both on No Child Left Behind and the Common Core, here's
something. Wait a minute, you didn't give me my chance.
You'll be able to work it in. I have no fear. If I overlook you, I know Hanushek will work it in and somehow. So here's something that sticks in the conservative craw, the 10th Amendment. Powers not granted by the Constitution of the United States to the federal government belong to the states. And here you are establishing national standards. Rick?
Well, I have not been heavily involved in either side of this debate. The argument is that it's been pushed from the Department of Education. The Department of Education says, no, it was a voluntary association of the national governors to get together. But, that's, to me, let me respond to Paul's mischaracterization of my position. I'm not against strong standards. I think that they're good in having rigorous standards.
National standards.
In national standards, there's a question about how you get to them and so forth. My concern is that there's a big difference between saying what kids should know and having them actually know it. And when we look across the individual states today, which have had a cacophony of different standards, we find no correlation between how rigorous the standards are of an individual state and how well the students do in terms of achievement. And so to me, it comes back to what Paul was saying, that you can't give up on the things that are pushing kids to learn more: accountability, choice, pay that's related to performance of teachers.
Okay, a last question, sort of from outside the box in which you've written your book. Milton Friedman, voucher proposal, which is now, I think it must be over half a century, or close on half a century.
60 years.
Yeah. Simple idea. Instead of giving state money to the schools, we give it to the parents and let them spend it on any school they want. Quote, Milton, if we had a system of free choice, we would also have a system of competition, innovation, which would change the character of education. The only solution is to break the monopoly and give the customers alternatives. Close quote. Because our public schools represent government-run monopolies, don't waste time trying to reform it here and reform it there. Break the monopoly.
Well, I'm very sympathetic to that point of view, and I've supported school vouchers for a very long period of time. And I think the charter school movement is...
Tell us what a charter school is.
A charter school is being created in many of the states whereby the school operates on its own. It's got to get parents to come there. The government pays if the parents choose it. So it's almost exactly like a voucher, except for one thing. You can't have religious instruction because it's authorized by the state.
And it's a public school.
Well, yes. And so, but the key thing is there's choice. Mm-hmm. The parents have choice. There's competition among these charter schools. So that sector, it's not perfect. It's got lots of problems with it.
The charter
school sector, it's now about 6% of the students in the United States are going to charter schools. And it does seem to be slowly getting better. What we know about the traditional public school is that it hasn't gotten better. It doesn't show signs of improvement. So Milton's insight seems to be relevant for explaining the differences between what's happening in the charter sector and the public school sector. But I think it's a little, we shouldn't expect miracles overnight. It takes a long time for a choice. If you could put Milton Friedman's ideas into place overnight, and you can't, it would still take a long time. And so you don't want to have that as your one and only strategy. You need a multi-pronged strategy for school reform. We can't wait.
Could I just Please. Give one summary statement that relates to Milton Friedman? He wrote Capitalism and Freedom, which included the voucher proposal. It also included statements about free international trade and about the advantages of capitalist systems and so forth. And it might be kind of surprising to note that today the communist Berlin Wall has fallen, communism has collapsed, we have essentially free international trade throughout much of the world, and it's led to growth in much of the world. The only thing that hasn't happened that was in Capitalism and Freedom is that we've fixed our schools.
From a report in the U.S. News, this is the last quotation. U.S. News this past January, quote, although President Barack Obama did not lay out any new plans for education reform in his State of the Union address Tuesday, Obama chose to kick off his speech with a teacher anecdote. Today in America, this is quoting the president, today in America, a teacher spent extra time with a student who needed it and did her part to lift America's graduation rate, close quote. If you could offer the president of the United States one or two sentences of advice on education, what would you say, Paul?
Well, it's great that the president supports education. I think that's one of the good things about this president. He's been trying to support reform.
Even as he's gutted No Child Left Behind?
Well, he's tried to replace it with some alternatives, including support for charter schools, including support for merit pay. Mm-hmm. I don't want to fault the president altogether when it comes to education policy. But I don't think he's followed through. I don't think he's able to really do more than
that lack of seriousness that you talk about again and again in the book.
It's easy on the rhetoric side. It's hard work on implementation.
I'd say one other thing on this. We've had this fixation on getting high school graduation rates up, and that's probably is important. but only if the kids know something when they graduate.
Anybody can get graduations rates up. Here, kid, here's a diploma. Here's
precisely,
one for you.
Precisely. And what the central message of our book is that what people know in terms of actual achievement and skills and math and science is what's important. And it's not how many years of schooling they've had. It's what they know.
A decade, so let me tighten it up. A decade from, you said we rank 32nd in math right now. A decade from now, when you write your Endangering Prosperity Revisited in 2024, where will we rank, Rick?
I'm actually the optimist of the
group. Oh, you're the optimist? I got it wrong.
You missed this. I'm the optimist because I have seen this action of half the states, at least, that have made real attempts to change the way schools are operated and to pay attention to the quality of teachers, how they're evaluated, how they're paid, who's kept in the schools. And I think it's actually in the interest of the teachers' unions to get behind this, or else they're going to get run over, frankly. The teachers' unions today are in a bit of turmoil, because they don't know if they should just stand up and say, we want more pay, and that's it, or whether they should pay attention.
Does this have the nature, you mentioned earlier the Berlin Wall came down, does this feel to you like communist Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union in the old days, where when it began to collapse, it happened fast? That what we knew, what we learned in 1989 was that that system was rotten through and through. Does it feel to you like we reach some critical point of political will and it changes quickly?
I'm not sure about that because, you know, the other side, if I were Paul on the pessimist side here, I would point out that 2 years ago we had this awful strike in Chicago schools,
right,
where the schools were closed down for a couple weeks on the platform of good old unionism, pay us more, that's what we care about. And so it's a struggle right now within the teachers' unions, within the teacher corps, which is not the same as the teachers' unions, and within the public. Why I am optimistic, though, is that so many state legislatures have now started to say, look, we just have to do something. We're convincing.
Let me give you a couple of things. One is there are two countries in the world that did improve a lot in a very short period of time. One is Korea. Coming out of the Korean War, they were a desperate country, and they are now top of the world in terms of educational performance. It can be done. Poland, after the wall came down, the Polish educational system has made remarkable gains in very short period of time. Germany has made substantial gains after the wall came down, and they had to incorporate Eastern Germany into the rest of the society. So, and in the United States, there's Florida. And Florida has made remarkable gains. And it had great leadership when those gains were being made. It's very interesting that the Florida school system is not improving at significant rates right now. It's sort of stagnated in the last few years. But when it had a very strong governor,
is that what it takes? Jeb Bush.
It takes that kind of leadership. It takes somebody who's truly passionately committed, makes this the central issue, and is capable. Yes, we need strong governors to provide that leadership.
All right. Paul Peterson, Rick Hanushek, co-authors of Endangering Prosperity. Thank you. I'm Peter Robinson for the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal. Thank you.